You know, there are lots and lots of people out there writing lots and lots of words about the United States Constitution. I mean, movies, articles, books. You remember about a year ago, the movie Lincoln came out? We talked all about that. Today, we're going to talk about another couple of pieces of writing about the Constitution. The first of them is all about the Second Amendment. It's actually an academic paper, a thesis, a senior honors thesis done by one of my students at Emory and Henry College. We'll get to that one actually second, because before that, we're going to talk about a different type of legal writing. We're going to talk about the novelist Steve Barry. Now, he's sold millions and millions of books. They're thrillers. And believe it or not, his latest book is a thriller about the Constitution. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this time it's all about reading and writing about the United States Constitution.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law.
I was sitting at home the other day, and my good buddy, the quiz guy, Doug Smith of Montpelier, gave me a call, and he said, hey, Stuart, got somebody for you to interview. Now, this is a fairly typical thing. Doug runs into lots of interesting people over at Montpelier on his many travels, and he said, I've got this guy named Steve Barry. And I scratched my head for a moment. I'd heard the name or I'd seen the name before, but he wasn't a judge. He wasn't, as far as I knew, a law professor. So I said, well, what am I going to talk to Steve Barry about, Doug? And he said, oh, about his new book about the Constitution. And I said, okay, what's it called? And he said, well, it's called The Lincoln Myth. And I just kept scratching my head. And finally I said, well, Doug, I'm sorry, but who is this guy? And he said, you know, Steve Barry. He writes thrillers. And then I remembered where I'd seen the name. You see his name in airport bookshops or at other bookshops or perhaps online when you're on Amazon or something. And I said, well, wait a second. He writes thrillers. And he said, yeah, yeah. He's written a thriller about the Constitution. Well, I find the Constitution thrilling, and I'm sure that you do too. But not everyone does. And so the thought that you have an airport thriller novel about the Constitution struck me sort of odd. But then he began to explain. And then I said, ah, now I see. And so I called up Steve Barry, and we had ourselves a really interesting talk. And it turns out he's come up with a fascinating premise that I think you'll enjoy very, very much. And it involves, of all people, Abraham Lincoln and Joseph Smith. Well, Steve Barry, who are you and what do you do?
I write novels for a living. I was a lawyer for 30 years, but now I write thrillers, and I've been doing that now. This will be my 12th year.
Well, Steve, I think you have just stated the fantasy of about, oh, two-thirds of the practicing bar.
It is true. Lawyers do have a lot of stories inside them, and they do like to tell them. And the only thing about mine is I never really wrote about the law. You know, I adhere to this philosophy that writing what you know is very bad advice. I don't think that's good advice at all. Instead, you write what you love. And I loved history, mystery, secrets, conspiracies, international settings. Those were my things. So I gravitated towards international suspense thrillers.
Well, tremendous. This is really exciting. Before we get to discussing your latest novel, which will be coming out soon on May 20th, I believe, which is called The Lincoln Myth, I want to hear about you. So just you mentioned that you had been a lawyer for 30 years. Tell us a little bit about that. Where'd you practice?
I practiced in a little town called St. Mary's, Georgia, which is located on the coast right above Jacksonville, Florida, right on the line. Mm-hmm. We have the Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base there, which is a huge complex, and I was a trial lawyer there for 30 years. I was in court probably 3-4 days every week. I did an enormous amount of divorces, criminal defense, anything in a courtroom, but I also did the everyday stuff to pay the bills. I called myself, I was basically a street lawyer. Whatever came in off the street, we took care of it.
Yeah, that's what I specialized in. My wife and I had a practice down in Orange Park when we lived in Northeast Florida. But it seems that some of the same time that you were practicing, we were there in the 1990s, and we said we specialized in whatever came in the front door.
That's exactly right. I always said that I did an awful lot of a little. It was just a lot of a little, you know, just $50 here, $100 there. You know, after a while, that starts to add up.
Indeed it does. In fact, I remember the day we got our first dog bite case. I looked at her and she looked at me and I said, well, I guess we really are small town lawyers now.
Yes, I did several of those, in fact.
I understand. I'm just curious now, did you ever do any constitutional stuff? Because, you know, that's the focus of our show, and I'm just curious as to whether in your practice you were exposed to anything that later made its way into your books.
I did do a little. I was very fortunate that I did five questions of first impression that went to the appellate courts. These were questions that have never been decided before in the law. None rose to the level of a constitutional argument except one, which I did. I challenged the constitutionality of the mayor's court in a local town there in order to get a conviction reversed. And I was able to reverse the conviction because the mayor's court violated a 1968, I believe, United States Supreme Court decision. And I was took that up to the Georgia Court of Appeals, and they agreed with me that the mayor's court of Kingsland was unconstitutional.
Well, I know we want to talk about your book, and believe me, we will, but I have to ask, what is a mayor's court, and why was it unconstitutional?
It just what it says. The mayor himself sat as the judge of the court, which was a common practice in South Georgia for many years. But finally, in the 1960s, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that if the mayor is also an authoritative figure, not just not a figurehead, but someone that, who has actual mayoral powers, then it is a conflict of interest for him to sit on the court. Because you have to understand, he would have an interest in ruling in a guilty plea, because the money from that fine would go into his coffers. So, you know, they said if the mayor's a figurehead, that's one thing. But if the mayor has actual authority, it's another thing. This mayor had huge authority in the city of Kingsland. He was almost like the sole authority of the town, which helped me rule the court unconstitutional.
Well, this actually sounds like what you had ruled unconstitutional was sort of standard, almost stereotypical small town Southern justice.
It was, and that was the way it was for many years until finally the Warren Court in the 60s put an end to that when they said, look, this is not fair. The guy that's ruling on the guilt and innocence in a mayor's court is also has an interest in making sure money comes into that city. Judges have to be neutral and detached, and they ruled that that was not a neutral and detached magistrate.
So, Steve, you are responsible for having overturned Boss Hogg justice in South Georgia.
It was, and it was very interesting. A quick side note, I went to the mayor before I started it, and I told him what I was going to do. I said, I'm going to challenge the constitutionality of your court. Would you like to just vacate the sentence of my client now, and I'll just go away, and we won't have to bring all this up? And he was very arrogant, extremely arrogant. He told me, no, I'm not court. He just went on and on. And I said, okay, fine. And about 6 months later, the Georgia Court of Appeals said that his court was gone.
Well, I guess he regretted that decision.
Yeah, well, you always give him a chance. Always give him a chance, but he decided he wanted to fight.
Well, good for you, Steve, what an interesting beginning. Now, take us through your thought process. When did you realize that you wanted to segue from practice and begin writing thrillers?
I had a little voice in my head that told me to write, and it's not uncommon. Every writer that I've ever met has the same little voice. And it doesn't tell you to write a bestseller or sell a bunch of books or anything like that. It just says, sit down and write. And if you sit down and write, the little voice goes quiet. And I had that voice all during the 1980s. Finally, in 1990, I listened to it. I started writing. Unfortunately for me, though, it took 12 years from the day I wrote my first word to the day I sold my first word.
Right.
I had 85 rejections over five different manuscripts. So it was a very long process for me to finally make it. But in 2003, The Amber Room was published, and now I'm coming up now. This will be my 13th novel this year, and I'm able to do it full-time and make a living at it.
Well, that is remarkable. Now, all the lawyers and all the aspiring writers will want to know, when did you make time to write? And I use that phrase advisedly, make time, because I know you had to be busy.
Oh, no question, but I had a discipline. Writing is a discipline, is what it is. You have to set up a discipline that works for you, and I'm a morning person. So I would go into the office about 6:30 in the morning, and I'd work from around 6:30 to 9 on the novels. And literally, there was nobody there. Almost no one ever saw me write anything. I was always alone. And I would work on that 2-3 hours every morning, and I tried to do my 1,000 words every day. And I learned that discipline, and to this day, I still maintain that same discipline.
Well, I've heard that said by many people, by many writers, that is. You maintain a schedule and you have a word quota each day, and even if you end up throwing out all those words the next day, you've made your quota.
All right. And that does happen a lot of times when you say, this is not really very good, and I need to rewrite it, because one of the rules of writing is rewriting. So you constantly are rewriting over and over.
Yeah, I actually used to hear the phrase when I was teaching at the University of Florida, there is no good writing, there's only good rewriting.
That's exactly, that's the same thing. The same thing what I'm saying is writing is rewriting. It's just over and over and over. I go through all of my novels around between 60 and 70 times. I go through those novels, start to finish. So I go through them so much that I never want to read them again.
Well said, sir. Well said. Well, one of your recurring characters, and I'm sure this is familiar to many people, because you've sold quite a few books now, is a character called Cotton Malone, and he is the star, or at least one of the stars, of your current book. So why don't we begin by saying, who's this Cotton Malone, and then we'll talk about his latest adventure.
Well, he was born one evening. I was in Copenhagen. I was in a place called the Café Nordon, which is in Hybro Plads. It's a big square there in Copenhagen. And it's a lovely evening. I was sitting up on the second floor looking out the square, and all at once he came in my brain. I said, this guy is going to be a retired Justice Department agent. He's going to get out early. He's going to move to Copenhagen. He's going to have an old bookshop right here in Hybro Plads. And from that bookshop, he'll get himself into trouble an awful lot. And that's where the Templar legacy was born. That was in 2006.
Okay.
Since then, Cotton has had 8 adventures, and the 9th one is coming May 20th. And he's an interesting guy. I modeled him a lot on me. I used my personality a lot in Cotton.
Are you a former secret agent?
That's the only thing I don't do. I live vicariously those parts. I don't shoot guns and jump out of planes like he does. But a lot of his attitudes, his fears, his beliefs, a lot of those came from me because I didn't know if Cotton was going to get to stay around. And I was hoping he'd get to stay around after the Templar legacy, so it was just easier to use me. And since then, Cotton has grown a lot. There's been a lot of changes in his life. And this book is an interesting one coming up May 20th because Cotton is going to experience an emotion that he has never before experienced in his life, the emotion of jealousy. And he's going to have to deal with that in the context of the Lincoln myth.
Well, that is a wonderful introduction. So what is this Lincoln myth about?
Lincoln is an interesting character in American history. You know, in the first 20 years after he died, he was pretty much vilified. I mean, no one really cared to even speak his name. He was not really much to Abraham Lincoln. Then around the turn of the century, things began to change, and now we have this myth about him. There's some very interesting things about Lincoln that I think the reader is going to be surprised to know are not true. And there are things that are just part of this overall myth. And I came across them in doing the research, and then I came across some really interesting aspects of the Constitution, something that has fascinated me since law school. And it's the question of secession. Can a state leave the Union? Can they actually do that? Lincoln said no, and he was the first U.S. president to ever say that. The first 15 presidents had a totally different attitude on that subject, but Lincoln said no. And Lincoln then fought the Civil War, not to save the Union, but he fought the war to create the Union. And we deal with all of this in the Lincoln myth, and Cotton Malone gets caught up in this constitutional crisis.
Well, you said there were a couple of myths about Lincoln, and I don't want to give away too much, but could you share with us perhaps one of them that people commonly believe that your research has shown to not be true?
Well, there's no question of this one. This is a historical fact. Abraham Lincoln did not free a single slave, not one. Not one slave was freed by Abraham Lincoln. The Emancipation Proclamation only freed slaves in the rebellious states, of which he had no jurisdiction over. The slaves in the states that he did have jurisdiction over, he specifically exempted from the proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
So it freed no one, absolutely no one. And this leads to the next corollary, is that the Civil War was not fought over slavery. That was not the issue it was fought over. slavery was constitutional. The Constitution allowed slavery. It was perfectly legal under the Constitution of the United States. Lincoln conceded this point in his first inaugural address. He said, absolutely legal. I agree with you. And you don't fight a war over something that is constitutional. These are all part of the myths that we've created over Lincoln, that all of this happened for reasons completely contrary. And then there's the issue of the Mormon Church.
Oh, well, that sounds intriguing. What did you find out about the Mormon Church?
There's a connection between Abraham Lincoln and the Mormon Church. In fact, Lincoln was the very first president of the United States to read the Book of Mormon. We know that because he checked it out of the Library of Congress in July of 1862 and kept it for 8 months. In January of 1863, Lincoln made a secret deal with Brigham Young, who was the head of the Mormons in Utah, a deal that changed the course of the Civil War. I'm not making that up. That's actually true. It actually did happen. And all of this, the Lincoln myth, revolves around what happens there. The Mormon Church has had a very interesting connection to American history, and I've always wanted to explore that, and this novel will deal with that.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with best-selling author Steve Barry all about his newest book, The Lincoln Myth, which, believe it or not, centers on a constitutional conspiracy. Can it even get any better than that? After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Steve Barry. So stick around.
Well, Doug Smith wearing a purple tie with what looked like little oranges and carrying a bottle of some sort of libation. It looks like some sort of bottle of rum. Why in the world did you? Well, welcome. Welcome.
Hello, Stuart. How are you? Sorry, I'm just coming from a Jimmy Buffett concert.
That's what it is. So you have a bottle of rum with you.
No, just kidding. No, I brought rum into the studio today because we're talking about prohibition.
I see. It's just a prop, then.
It just depends on how well the contestant does.
I see. It's a prop at the moment, but if you really disappoint us, we may have to take a shot or two here. Well, speaking of contestants, who is on the line?
My name's Scott Schultz. I'm from Irwin, Tennessee.
Scott Schultz from Irwin, Tennessee. Now, I've heard of Irwin. I think that's somewhere near Johnson City. Where exactly is that?
It is. It's about 15 minutes from Johnson City, actually.
Well, that's tremendous. Well, we're so happy to have you with us. Doug, do you have a question for Scott today?
Well, I do. And Scott, welcome. You'll be happy to know that this is not about rum per se, but it is about prohibition.
A
very constitutional subject. It's about...
Well, I thought he'd be drinking a little bit.
Well, actually, he has taken a couple of snorts already, so... We'll see how long he lasts.
So that's the beauty of radio, Scott. We'll see whether you should be drinking or not. Okay, so here's the question. How did the 18th Amendment prohibition change ecclesiastical practices?
What?
Now, this is the question. How would prohibition change ecclesiastical practices? I'm going to give you some choices here. Would it be A... It ensured the United Methodists would only ever use Welch's grape juice for communion. B, Catholics had to argue before the Supreme Court that Eucharist was really the blood of Christ, and so it was no longer alcohol.
Ah, of course.
C, Jewish Purim got really, really boring. Or D, none. The First Amendment protected the Hooch for the Lord movement.
That is a fascinating question, and I must say, Doug, that's the first time anyone's ever suggested to me that transubstantiation avoided the avoided a violating prohibition. That's a tremendous argument. But I don't really know which one of those is true. So, Scott, what do you think about those choices?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it was C. But I think I need to hear the choices one more time, too.
Okie dokie.
So the choices are... A, it ensured the Methodists would only ever use Welch's grape juice. B, Catholics had to argue before the Supreme Court that the Eucharist was really the blood of Christ, and therefore no longer wine. C, Jewish Purim suddenly got really boring. Or D, none. The First Amendment protected the Hooch for the Lord movement.
Scott?
Okay. Well, I don't think it would be the Methodist church one either, and because I don't think it would just apply to one particular religion. So I definitely don't think it's A or C. So I guess I'm torn between B and D. What was B again?
That the Catholics would have to argue before the Supreme Court that the body of Christ was in the Eucharist. Therefore, it really was no longer wine. The blood of Christ, rather.
Can you imagine a magistrate saying, Mr. O'Malley, you're being charged with violation of the Volstead Act? And he says, no, no, Judge, by the time I put it in my mouth, it was no longer wine. It was the blood of Christ, and that's legal.
And this goes directly to the reason that this is a constitutional issue.
Okay, Scott, we've bantered enough. What do you think? Which one?
I guess I'm going to go with, oh, man. Oh, man, it's tough. I'm torn between it because I can see. I'm going to go with D, though, because I know that churches can use wine. So I'm going to go with D.
That the First Amendment protected people's, what, free exercise?
It is. It's free exercise. Absolutely.
So did he get it right?
He did get it right.
Congratulations, Scott. You got it right.
Yeah. When they were bantering about, speaking of bantering, the Volstead Act, what happened was the religious community said, hey, you can't really tell us whether we can use alcohol or not in our ceremonies because then you are, in fact, impeding the practice of religion. And so, in fact, there was no prohibition on ecclesiastical practices.
The only place you could get a drink was a church.
Hey, I'm not saying that it was a great move for the Catholic Church to advocate for this, but as you're suggesting, yes, in fact, this is where the First Amendment comes down, is you can't impede that practice or non-practice of religion.
Well, that's just wonderful. I'm going to add to this is that sacramental wine, as it was often called, became one of the biggest loopholes in Prohibition, and priests and ministers and other clergy people became some of the primary suppliers of hooch to their congregations all throughout the United States. So it was one of the many inconsistencies and perhaps unintended effects of Prohibition.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the 18th Amendment was largely driven by the temperance movement, which came out of things like the United Methodist Church or the Congregationalist Church. You know, this was not the Catholic Church. This was very Protestant, mostly as we moved west, this Campbellstone movement.
Right.
These temperance movements really were the drivers of the 18th. And then, of course, we had to unwrap that in the 20th Amendment.
Indeed. The only time we've ever repealed
21st.
An amendment.
That's right. The 21st Amendment. We had to undo our whoopsie.
Indeed, we did. Well, Scott, that's tremendous news for you. You get a Weekly Constitutional T-shirt. And so please email your size to us at ywc@montpelier.org. That's ywc@montpelier.org. And we'll have one in the mail to you. And I'm going to use this as an opportunity to remind everybody that if you'd like to win a T-shirt, just like Scott just did, email us at the same address, ywc@montpelier.org. And next time we do some quizzes, we'll put you on our list. Scott, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
All right. And thank you, Doug.
Hey, thanks, Stuart. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles. Cheers.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today, my guest, or one of my first guests, is best-selling author Steve Barry, and he's telling me all about his brand new novel, just about to be released, called The Lincoln Myth. Now, it's based upon a constitutional conspiracy, and I'm not going to give away too much, but I'll simply say this. The conspiracy has something to do with secession.
We have actually discussed secession on this program, and I will certainly agree with you that the war, the immediate cause of the war, was secession. But of course, the underlying reason, that the underlying conflict, that perhaps the primary reason many of the southern states seceded, was, of course, slavery. I mean, you'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Not necessarily, no. I think it had something to do with it. But the main reason they seceded is they fundamentally disagreed with the course of the federal government. They just didn't agree with it anymore. They didn't agree with where anything was going. Tariffs was an extremely hot issue at that time. Tariffs had been fought about for about 40 years. Southerners collected all of the tariffs because they had the ports, and that money went to the federal government. The federal government spent most of that money in the North. So they had a real fundamental problem with that. I think the states left the Union because they simply disagreed with the direction of the federal government, and they said, we no longer want to be a part of this. Slavery, of course, was one aspect of that. But you have to understand, Lincoln made a statement in 1862 in writing. He wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Tribune, and he said in the letter very clearly, if I can free no slave but save the Union, I will do it. If I can free some slaves save the Union, I will do it. Slavery for him was not the overriding concern. Creating the Union was his overriding concern. So there was a fundamental difference there. Lincoln was the first president to say, no, this is a indivisible Union. It cannot be broken. Now, that's a little bit absurd when you think about it. The Constitution never once in any point mentions the word perpetual union. Those words aren't used anywhere in the Constitution.
It does use. This is just an interesting discussion. It does, of course, say to form a more perfect.
There you go. That's exactly what it says. But look at it in the context of those words. Remember, the Articles of Confederation came first. And I think you know the whole title of the Articles of Confederation. They were called the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union.
Mm-hmm.
They only lasted 7 years, though, because they got to Philadelphia and they threw out the entire thing. All of them seceded from the perpetual union. They wrote a new constitution to form a more perfect union, which could very well be argued that wasn't perpetual, since what they were fleeing from was perpetual.
That's interesting. You're the first.
It's an interesting argument to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might say, well, in the Madison's notes of the Constitution, Constitutional Convention, there's no mention of any of this. You would be correct to that. But those notes are very suspect.
Oh, really? Well, now tell me more about that.
James Madison's notes are extremely suspect.
Well, tell us all about that. Why do you suspect Madison's notes?
Because Madison did not publish the notes until almost 34 years after the Constitutional Convention.
Mm-hmm.
He held on to them during that time. He specifically said that he had changed, embellished, and modified them to make them more readable. And he left specific instructions that the notes were never to be published until all participants to the convention were dead and he was dead. So there'd be no one left alive to contradict what he wrote. We literally have no idea what was actually said at the Constitutional Convention. We only know what Madison says was said.
Well, that's true. Madison's notes are the most extensive. But
we don't know if they're accurate, and by his own admission, he said that he had changed and modified them to make them more readable. We don't know what he left out of there. They could have had a very long discussion on the question of secession, and no one said a word. There's something to remember, too, about secession. When the states went to ratify the convention, there were three states in their ratification vote that specifically reserved the right to leave the Union if they wanted to. That was Virginia, Rhode Island, and New York. Specifically reserved the right in their ratification votes for the Constitution that they could walk away. And no one disagreed with that.
No one disagreed. On the other hand, those ratifications were seen as ultimately unconditional. I mean, they satisfied the requirement that you have at least 9 states ratify. This is all fascinating. It really is fascinating. And you are correct. There are some states that did that. So I'm guessing then that the great secret at the heart of your book, and I know you don't want to give away the ending, but apparently there is a secret document that we find about in the very first pages of the book that's passed down from president to president. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that has something to do with this issue of secession.
Oh yes, it does, and this passing down got messed up when Lincoln was assassinated because he died before he could pass it on. And so he was the first president to actually, you know, to be killed in office, and he never got a chance to pass that down and pass it on. He wasn't the first president to die in office, but he was the first one to not have this opportunity to pass it on. And so I just sort of tweak history just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I have to give it a little tweak. The Supreme Court of the United States has only considered the issue of secession one time in 1869,
mm-hmm.
in the case of Texas v. White.
Right.
If you read that opinion, it's one of the most poorly reasoned, poorly put together opinions you could possibly imagine. It basically just says secession is illegal because it's illegal because we say it's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have any reasoning, rationale, or anything in there. And what were they going to do? I mean, come on. I mean, 600,000 people had just died in the Civil War, and they're going to rule the whole thing was unconstitutional? The outcome of that decision was absolutely never in doubt. The Chief Justice was served in Lincoln's cabinet. He wrote the opinion. And there's an interesting comment in the opinion, though. It says in there, and we have found nothing within American jurisprudence that says anything to the contrary about secession.
Mm-hmm.
So I just added something.
Very, very interesting. Our very first episode several years ago now was an interview with a fellow by the name of Kent Masterson Brown. He's a lawyer from Kentucky. Do you know Kent?
I do not.
He's also a lawyer and a historian, and he shares many of your beliefs with regard to secession and its constitutionality. And we had a very spirited discussion with him. And I'm mentioning this not just for you, but for our listeners. If people want to go and specifically discuss these issues or listen to a discussion of these issues, you should go to our podcast site and look up our very first episode. It's called The Constitutionality of Secession. But now getting back to you, Steve, I think you and Kent might have a lot to talk about. So you should Google him sometime, and maybe the two of you can get together and concoct another novel.
You know, what's very interesting, though, you know, the founding fathers, they fought a revolutionary war. They fought it for, you know, 7 long years. They fought to throw off the yoke of a totalitarian government.
Mm-hmm.
Does it make any sense that they would go to Philadelphia, sit down and create another one? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever that they would go and say, we're going to create a union here that can never, ever, ever be broken, ever. It will be this way forever. No matter how much you may disagree, no matter how much the federal government may get out of control, no matter anything, you're stuck in here. It doesn't make any sense. And when I started this novel, I didn't really think that. But as I did the research and came to look at it, it makes more sense to me that they left the issue of secession silent in the Constitution, meaning that it's a possibility. It still exists out there.
Well, I think we have given our listeners lots of intriguing things to think about, and probably lots of them will now want to go and buy your book. So let's talk specifically about it. It's called The Lincoln Myth, and it's going to be out on the 20th of May. And I'm imagining that they can get it through the usual conduits, the bookstores or on Amazon, that sort of thing.
Sure. It's in all formats. It'll be in hardcover, e-audio, large print. It'll be hopefully all over the place.
Tremendous. You also have a website?
I do. It's steveberry.org. We'll tell you all about me and the books and all things that we're working on.
That's one word, Steve Berry, and it's steveberry.org. I'm looking at the website right now. I'm looking at your page here. And Steve, I really appreciate you coming on the show and telling us about this really interesting concept.
Thank you so much, and I hope folks will give the book a try.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've just been speaking with Steve Berry, the best-selling author of the soon-to-be-published Lincoln Myth. After the break, we will speak with another author. His name is Colin Christensen, and though he's not a best-selling author yet, maybe he will be. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now I'm going to speak with another author. This one is more of an academic type, or at least someone who wants to be an academic type. You see, his name is Colin Christensen, and he is a graduating senior this spring of 2014 at Emory and Henry College, an absolutely marvelous educational institution in southwestern Virginia with which I have the honor of being associated. You see, last fall, I taught a course, an undergraduate seminar on the First Amendment, and Colin was one of my students. And I must say he was a real standout, not just that he was academically very qualified, not just that he wrote me a marvelous term paper, but that he wasn't afraid of me. He wasn't afraid of me at all. In fact, in our very first class, he said something that irritated the heck out of me, and he just kind of kept going from there. And so every week, Colin and I would get into it, and we would go back and forth, and the other students would jump in, and it was just a marvelous exchange. And I was very pleased when my friend, Professor Joe Lane of the Politics Department at Emory and Henry, asked me if I would be on the panel that evaluated Colin's senior honors thesis. And just recently, I sat in on that panel, and no surprise, the panel voted unanimously to approve the thesis and to let Colin graduate with honors. And I was so impressed by it. I was so impressed by his analysis, his perspective on the Second Amendment. They said, hey, Colin, let's walk over a couple of buildings. Let's go to the studios of your campus station here, WEHC, which happens to carry your weekly constitutional. Hello, Teresa. Hello, Richard. We walked over to the studios of WEHC, and Richard Graves, the station manager, graciously gave us some time. And here is what resulted.
Well, my name is Colin Christensen. I am a senior at Emory and Henry College studying philosophy, politics, and economics. I'm about to graduate here in about 2 weeks, and after that, head off to UC Berkeley. What do? I write on the Second Amendment quite frequently. I just published a piece in the Columbia Undergraduate Law
Review. We're getting too far ahead of ourselves.
Too far, okay.
Not too far. I want to ask you, what was your favorite class at Emory and Henry?
My favorite class? I guess I have to calculate which professors are listening to this, shouldn't I? I would think that my favorite class was constitutional law with Joe Lane. But my second favorite class must have been Great Works in Context, a class on Homer's Iliad.
Okay. And your next favorite class?
Probably social theory.
Oh, okay. Eventually, we'll get down to the First Amendment seminar that I taught you, right? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I'm glad I didn't even make the top three, and I'm not even going to check to see if I made the top 10. But anyway, that's how we know each other. I've taught a course in the First Amendment here, and Colin was one of my star students. You were one of my star students, along with several other. It was an excellent seminar. We had, seven or eight students in there.
Right.
And I don't think there was a bad apple among them. That was really a great, great class, and enjoyed it. So that's how we know each other. And we're at the studio here at WEHC recording this. Thank you, WEHC. We appreciate you letting us use your facilities for this. And now we're going to talk about this thing you mentioned, the Second Amendment. What exactly did you do the Second Amendment paper for?
I think my own personal pleasure.
Your own personal pleasure?
Yes.
You sound like a future law professor.
I hope to be someday. Uh-huh. I do. So I wrote this piece about the Second Amendment and the Supreme Court's treatment of the Second Amendment.
This is for a senior thesis.
For a senior thesis.
For your honors program.
Correct,
okay.
Correct. Actually, though, I completed the paper my junior year. I got way ahead of myself. I presented it at two different conferences, one in Boston and one in Orlando, to get kind of comprehensive feedback, and then ultimately worked with Columbia University to publish it in their undergraduate law review last April. So it's been a long time. It's been a long process to get from the initial writing phase, which probably started my second year, to today, where I just defended it in its thesis format.
And in fact, defended it among or in front of a distinguished board that included both the person I refer to as the other Professor Harris, Professor Priscilla Harris, and me. And, of course, Professor Joe Lane, whom you've already mentioned, and Professor Shelley Koch as well sociology. And we really put you through the ringer, didn't we?
Yeah, it was tough. It was an invigorating discussion, that's for sure.
An invigorating discussion. Tremendous. All right. Now, finally, we know what this paper is, where it's come from, why we're talking about it. And now tell us about your thesis, and what did you say about the Second Amendment?
Well, I think the long short of my argument is that the Supreme Court treats the Second Amendment in its recent case, the District of Columbia versus Heller, in such a way that relies so heavily on common law aspects that are more akin to self-defense than they really do construct an emphatic right to just firearm ownership, that what they've done is created this association between gun ownership and self-defense that relies on tenets of the common law theory of the Castle Doctrine, which is a common law defense for homeowners that use deadly force upon home intruders.
And that comes from that old adage, a man's home is his castle.
Right.
And the common law, which is why we had the other Professor Harris in there, because she teaches torts, and it's a common law tort concept, is that you have a right to self-defense, generally speaking, and that right is to a great degree enhanced when you are in your home, because that is your castle. And so you're saying that this common law doctrine, which is not constitutional, in fact, it predates the Constitution by many, many years, is something that Justice Scalia and the majority of the court brought in to constitutional analysis in the 2008 Heller decision.
Right, correct.
Well, I'm glad I got that part of it. Now, what's the problem with that? What's the problem with bringing in this doctrine?
I think the problem is, first of all, common law rights are our common law, right? These are rights that are generally accepted as within the judiciary as being, you know, equally enjoyed by all citizens, regardless of their constitutional authority. And I think the problem that I perceive within my analysis is that what we have here in the Second Amendment now is a constitutional right to self-defense with a firearm. Whereas under the common law, everyone enjoys a common law right to self-defense. Certainly, if you hit me in the studio, I'm entitled to you know, justly hit you right back.
So you'd have that common law right, and that has been now constitutionalized in the context of keeping and bearing arms, and so that's somehow been tied into gun ownership.
Correct. And I think that's, well, the association between firearms and self-defense is a peculiarly American conception, but constitutionally speaking, and I guess in a legal sense, the problem is that there's no greater right enjoyed by any American citizen than those rights that are codified within the Constitution. And if we treat that seriously, then now we have citizens that own firearms being privileged to a constitutional protection of self-defense, whereas citizens that don't own a firearm or possess a firearm only enjoy that common law right to self-defense. And we have to recognize that despite the common law being enjoyed equally by all, constitutionally speaking, within our system of governance, that the constitutional protections we enjoy are the emphatically greatest protections offered to anybody. So we have the greatest protection, the highest law of our land, upholding a right to self-defense so long as it is effectuated with a firearm.
And let me just back up a step or two and acknowledge that the very idea that the Second Amendment involves this right of self-defense, this common law right, was novel. I mean, before Heller, well, in one sense, before Heller, everything about the Second Amendment was novel because the court had never really comprehensively interpreted it. So it was a case, in some sense, of first impression. But to the extent the court had interpreted it before Heller, and primarily in the Miller case from 1939, it had suggested that what the Second Amendment was really about was the militia.
Right.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Correct.
I think that's a verbatim statement of it. So it was always about militias, but Justice Scalia and the majority of the court in Heller said, no, it's also about this common law right of self-defense. And in fact, what the Constitution did, he said, was it codified something in the common law and put it in our highest law. And that's where you think then possibly a problem arises because, and let me, one more thing I want to say, a little bit of a background. Common law rights can always be modified by a legislature. I mean,
correct.
If the state of Michigan or the state of California or the state of Wisconsin wants to tweak this right of self-defense, wants to come up with its own version of the castle defense, well, guess what? They have done that. I mean, all over the country, you've got these states having modified the common law. But by putting that common law right into the Constitution, now you've greatly limited the rights of these states to modify things.
Right.
Is that what you're driving at?
Yeah, I think there are two unique legislative barriers that are constructed within the Heller reasoning. Because we have to keep in mind that Heller's reasoning, insofar as it codifies or constitutionalizes this right to armed self-defense, it does so with the intention of allowing individual citizens the right to protect themselves within their homes. So we are given this reasoning that establishes two, I think, very distinct defenses. The first defense is one of body, right? We have the right to protect ourselves. But the second is very clear from the language in Heller that you also have a right to protect your family and your home, the physical property of your home, because it is historically held so sacred to us. And I think those are two very distinct legislative barriers that are erected because we have some states that don't recognize the use of deadly force as a legitimate use of self-defense, and we have other states that don't recognize the use of deadly force in the name of protecting your property as legitimate either. But Heller recognizes both, and insofar as it is applied against the states constitutionally, I think that's where we have the most kind of dubious trajectory for how the states can then respond within their own common law.
And that's happened because Heller, of course, involved only federal law. It was in the District of Columbia.
Correct.
And interpreted most narrowly, it was a situation within a home. It was Dick Heller who had wanted to have a handgun for self-protection in his home. But then the court took that case and applied it to the states through a process we call incorporation in City of Chicago versus McDonald in 2010. And that's right. Where the rubber hit the road for you, right? Because now it's going to limit the states.
Right. And I think, you know, there, in McDonald, we see a fundamental power shift, right? So historically speaking, we have the 1939 Miller case, which is kind of more or less a, sure, it's constitutional doctrine, but it doesn't really tell us a whole lot about the relationship between the Second Amendment and the individual states. And so the reach of Heller is necessarily limited because the District of Columbia is a federal enclave. And so the relationship between the Second Amendment has kind of always been understood as one with the federal government, right? The federal government cannot limit our right to bear arms and serve in the militia. But then McDonald versus Chicago changes this power relation, and we get a Second Amendment right that is applied equally to the federal government as well as the individual states. So now we are really limiting what individual state legislatures can do to regulate the you know, use and possession of firearms.
And as you pointed out in your paper, when we see these rights, constitutional rights, get incorporated against the states, that is something in the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, Second Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, first is applied against the federal government, protects us against federal infringement, but then bit by bit, one by one, over the last century or so, these rights are then applied against the states. And every time one of these rights has been applied to the states, then it starts to expand.
Right.
As the court begins to expound upon it, then they find more situations where the right is infringed by the state government, and so the right broadens. And that seems to be your concern, is you're concerned about this right broadening beyond the limits of Heller and McDonald, beyond just protecting yourself in your home, but actually letting you tote your gun all around town, letting you walk around
right.
town and pack heat.
Exactly.
You talk about that some?
Yeah, sure. I think in my paper, it tries to pull out as many of the legal nuances to this concept of the Castle Doctrine as possible. So I think the treatment of that trajectory of incorporation, as I call it, and I think as many other legal scholars call it, treats the expansion of the Second Amendment as an expansion of the Castle Doctrine, or at least as a function of the expansion of the Castle Doctrine. So if we look at the kind of very iconic, you know, Blackstonian ideal of the Castle Doctrine, what that is literally the walls of your home, right? This dwelling, that is your castle. But then in the American tradition, we see this castle become expanded to the curtailage of your property, to your office, to your...
Now, you're using some fancy terms here. Now,
well,
curtilage means the area right around
your
house.
Yard,
okay,
your,
right.
Right, your yard, your driveway, you know, what if you're in your car...
And you said Blackstonian, and we're referring, of course, to the famous legal commentator.
Yeah, William right. Blackstone, right.
Right.
What I argue is that if we can trace a trail of breadcrumbs, so to speak, of how the Castle Doctrine expanded to be more inclusive for areas in which we may use, you know, defense of self and defense of property, so far as it, to the extent of deadly force. Then we can also see a pathway along which the Castle Doctrine has already left its footprints that the Second Amendment may follow in its own expansion. And I think for that matter, there's enough constitutional doctrine out there that shares a kinship between these places where we have rights to be, rights to privacy, that we may even see this within the expansion of the Fourth Amendment. Obviously, there's a rich, rich constitutional history of expansion of Fourth Amendment rights, and I think a Second Amendment expansion insofar as where we can possess firearms legally for the use of self-defense could also follow a very similar path that the Fourth Amendment followed.
Yep. And right now, it's important to emphasize that arguments about whether you can pack heat or carry your gun in this area or that area, in a public place or in a school or wherever else, these are being debated legislatively. They're being debated in city councils, they're being debated in state legislatures, and to some extent debated in the United States Congress. And that's great. I mean, as long as the Second Amendment hasn't expanded and sort of taken over the field, then you can have different laws governing different areas regarding concealed carry, for example, all over the country. But once you've constitutionalized it, once the Second Amendment has spread into these areas, then you're limiting the options of the state and local and even federal governments, because ultimately that broader Second Amendment right might trump all of these.
Right. And I think we have to keep in mind that the Second Amendment is very volatile within our public discourse, right? There are people that have, exactly. Who would have thought, right?
Who would have thought it?
So the Second Amendment is like the sacred of sacreds, right? It is this right that people have a very cultural and attachment to, and maybe even they see their heritage and their self identity and community identities associated with firearm ownership. And so accordingly, I think there's a very emotive connection to the right to possess a firearm. So when the court, which we have no reason to think that they will not hear future cases that may, allow the Second Amendment scope to expand, but let's say they do hear these cases, which I think they will, then we have a bunch of individual communities that have much different laws that govern firearms within their states that now may run afoul of constitutionally protected federal principles that they otherwise have historically been treated as, within their emphatic province to legislate.
Yep, and that's what happens when the Supreme Court constitutionalizes an area of law, then to a great extent, the argument stops. Well, Colin, thank you for shedding some illumination on some, I think, often overlooked areas of Second Amendment jurisprudence. This is, a fascinating thesis. What happened? Are you going to graduate?
I am going to graduate, yes.
With honors?
With honors.
With honors. And you've already pointed out an earlier version of your paper has been published, and this also will be published by Emory and Henry.
Correct.
And then I'm sure people will be curious. You're such a young whippersnapper. What are your plans for going on?
So my plans, in August, I will be moving to Berkeley, California, to attend University of California at Berkeley's Bolt Hall School of Law, and I will be doing, or working towards a PhD in jurisprudence and social policy, and I think also complete a JD while I'm out there.
What do you want to do with all those fancy degrees?
All those fancy degrees, what I'm hoping to do is really make a meaningful impact on two areas of scholarship, the first area being Second Amendment legal history and future jurisprudence, and the second area being our constitutional construction more generally, perhaps through the context of the Second Amendment, perhaps not, but I think what is really fascinating, what I hope to make a very meaningful impact upon in the scholarship, and I think more so politically, is how the American gun culture works within our conceptions of rights and property and individualism, and more importantly, how these rights are also constructed and treated within our constitutional structures and how we go about that performance as well.
So you want to be a law professor.
Correct.
So in other words, Colin, you want to be like me.
We can say that. It's your radio show. We'll go with that.
Well, Colin Christensen, almost graduate, class of 2014 of Emory and Henry College. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to best-selling author Stephen Berry, author of the upcoming The Lincoln Myth. Thanks also to my former student, Colin Christensen. Good luck, Colin, in your future studies. I'm sure you'll do really well. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.